Chapter 57. Hickey. On the southwest cape of King William Island, 8 September, 1848. Calker's mate Cornelius Hickey hated kings and queens. He thought they were all blood-sucking parasites on the corpus ass of the body politic. But he found that he did not at all mind being king. His plan to sail and row all the way back to Terror Camp, or Terror herself, went a cropper when their pinnace, no longer so crowded, rounded the southwest cape of King William Land and encountered advancing ice pack. The open water narrowed to leads which led nowhere, or which closed ahead of them even as their boat tried to creep along the coast that now stretched ahead to the northeast. There was real open water much farther to the west, but Hickey could not allow the pinnace to be out of sight of land for the simple reason that no one left alive in their boat knew how to navigate at sea. The only reason that Hickey and Aylmore had been so generous as to allow George Hodgson to come with them, actually to seduce the young lieutenant into wanting to come with them, was that the fool had been trained, as all naval lieutenants were, in celestial navigation. But on their first day of man-hauling away from rescue camp, Hodgson admitted that he could not fix their position or navigate their way back to Terror at sea without a sextant. And the only remaining sextants were still in the possession of Captain Crozier. One of the reasons Hickey, Manson, Aylmore and Thompson had doubled back and lured Crozier and Goodsir out onto the ice was to somehow get one of those goddamned sextants. But there Cornelius Hickey's native cleverness had failed him. He and Dickie Aylmore failed to come up with any convincing reason that their Judas goat, Bobby Golding, could ask Crozier to bring his sextant out onto the ice with him. So they discussed torturing that toff Irish bastard into somehow sending a note back demanding the instrument be sent out from camp. But in the end, actually seeing his tormentor on his knees, Hickey had opted to kill him at once. So once they found open water, young Hodgson's usefulness even as a man-hauler was over, and Hickey soon had to dispatch him in a clean and merciful manner. It helped to have Crozier's pistol and extra cartridges for just such a purpose. In the first days after they'd returned with Goodsir and a food supply, Hickey had allowed Aylmore and Thompson to keep the two extra shotguns they'd seized. Hickey himself had been given the third one by Crozier the day they left rescue camp. But he soon thought better of having the extra weapons around and had Magnus toss them into the sea. This way was better. The king, Cornelius Hickey, having the pistol and control of the only shotgun and its cartridges, with Magnus Manson by his side. Aylmore was an effete, bookish-born conspirator, Hickey knew, and Thompson was a drunken lout who could never be fully trusted. Hickey knew such things by instinct and because of his innately superior intelligence. And when the Hodgson food supply ran short around the third day of September, Hickey sent Magnus to knock both men on the head, bind them up, and drag them half-senseless before the other dozen assembled men, where Hickey held a brief court-martial, found both Aylmore and Thompson guilty of sedition and of plotting against their leader and shipmates, and dispatched them both with a single bullet into the base of the brain. With all three sacrifices for the greater good, Hodgson, Aylmore, and Thompson, the damned surgeon Goodsir still refused to fulfill his role as dissector general. So for each refusal, Commander Hickey had been forced to mete out a punishment for the recalcitrant surgeon. There had been three such punishments, so Goodsir was certainly having trouble walking now that they'd been forced ashore again. Cornelius Hickey believed in luck, his own luck, and he'd always been a lucky man, but when luck failed him, he was always prepared to make his own. In this case, when they'd come around the huge cape at the southwest corner of King William Land, sailing when they could, rowing hard when the leads grew narrow so close into shore, and saw the solid pack ice ahead, Ikki had ordered the ship ashore, and they'd reloaded the pinnace onto the sledge. He didn't need to remind the men about how lucky they were. While Crozier's men were almost certainly dead or dying back there at rescue camp, or dying on the ice pack in the strait south of it, Hickey's chosen few had made it more than two-thirds, and possibly as much as three-quarters of the way back to Terra Camp, and all the supplies cached there. Hickey had decided that a leader of his stature, the reigning king of the Franklin expedition, should not be forced to manhaul. The men were certainly being fed well thanks to him, and thanks only to him, and should have no complaints about illness or lack of energy. So for this final part of the voyage, he had decided to sit in the stern of the pinnace atop the sledge and to allow his dozen surviving subjects, excluding only the limping good sir, to pull him across the ice, gravel, and snow as they rounded the north curve of the cape. For the last few days, Magnus Manson had ridden in the pinnace with him. And not simply because everyone now understood that Magnus was the king's consort, as well as Grand Inquisitor and Executioner. Poor Magnus was having stomach pains again. The primary reason that good sir was limping but still alive was that Cornelius Hickey had a deep fear of disease and contagion. The other men's illnesses back at rescue camp and before, the bleeding scurvy especially, had disgusted and terrified the Calker's mate. He needed a doctor along to attend to him, even though he had not yet shown the slightest sign of illness that so plagued such lesser men. Hickey's sledge team, Morfan, Oren, Brown, Dunn, Gibson, Smith, Best, Jerry, Work, Seeley, and Strickland, had also shown no signs of advancing scurvy, now that their diet consisted of fresh or almost fresh meat once again. Only good sir was looking and acting sick, and that was because the fool insisted on eating only the last few ship's biscuits and water. Hickey knew that he would soon have to step in and insist that the surgeon partake of a healthier antisorbutic diet. The fleshy parts, such as thigh, calf, and fore, and upper arm were the best, so that good sir did not die on them because of his own perverse stubbornness. A doctor, after all, should know better. Stale ship's biscuits and water might sustain a rat if nothing else were available, but it was not a diet for men. To make sure that good sir stayed alive, Hickey had long ago relieved the surgeon of all the medicines in his kit, watching over them himself, and allowing good sir to dole them out to Magnus or others only under careful supervision. He also made sure that the surgeon had no access to knives, and when they were out at sea, he always had one of his men assigned to watch to make sure good sir did not throw himself overboard. So far, the surgeon had shown no indications of choosing self-murder. Magnus's stomachache was now severe enough not only to keep the giant riding in the sledge-raised pinnace with Hickey during the day, but to keep him awake some nights. Hickey had never known his friend to have trouble sleeping. The two tiny bullet wounds were the cause, of course, and Hickey forced good sir to attend to them daily now. The surgeon insisted that the wounds were superficial and that any infection had not spread. He showed both Hickey and the innocently peering Magnus, holding up his shirt tails to peek with alarm at his own belly, how the flesh around the stomach was still pink and healthy.
"Then why the pain?" Hickey insisted. "It's like any bruise, especially a deep muscle bruise," said the surgeon. "It may continue to hurt for weeks, but it's not serious, much less life-threatening."
"Can you remove the balls?" asked Hickey.
"Cornelius," whined Magnus, "I don't want my balls removed."
"I mean the bullets, darling," said Hickey,
petting the giant's huge forearm.
"The little bullets that are in your belly."
"Perhaps," said good sir, "but it would be better if I did not try, at least while we are on the march. The operation would require cutting through muscle that has already largely healed. Mr. Manson might have to lie down for several days of recovery, and there would always be the serious risk of sepsis. If we were to decide to remove the bullets, I would feel much more comfortable doing so at Terra Camp
or when we are back at the ship, so the patient could recover in bed for several days or longer.
I don't want my tummy to hurt, rumbled Magnus.
No, of course you don't, said Hickey, rubbing his partner's huge chest and shoulders. Give him some morphine, good sir.
The surgeon nodded and meted out a bit of the painkiller into a spoon. Magnus always enjoyed his spoonfuls of morphine and would sit in the bow of the pinnace and smile sweetly for an hour or more before falling asleep after getting his doses. So on this Friday, the 8th day of September, all was right with King Hickey's world. His 11 dray animals, Morfan, Oren, Brown, Dunn, Gibson, Smith, Best, Jerry, Work, Seeley and Strickland, were well and free of disease and pulling hard each day. Magnus was happy most of the time. He enjoyed riding in the bow like an officer and looking back at the countryside they'd just crossed. And there was enough morphine and laudanum in the bottles to hold out until they reached Terra Camp, or Terra herself. Good Sir was alive and limping along with the caravan and attending to the king and his consort. The weather was good, although growing colder, and there was absolutely no sign of the creature that had preyed on them in previous months. Even with their vigorous diet, they had enough Aylmore and Thompson food stores left to provide stew over the next few days. They had found that human fat burned as fuel much as did whale blubber, although less efficiently and for shorter periods. Hickey had plans for a lottery after that if they needed one more sacrifice before they reached Terra Camp. They could go on shorter rations, of course, but Cornelius Hickey knew that a short straw lottery would instill terror into the heart of his 11 already compliant tray animals and reaffirm who was king of this expedition. Hickey was always a light sleeper, but now slept with one eye open and his hand on the percussion cap pistol. But one last public sacrifice, presumably with Magnus then having to dole out the fourth public punishment for non-compliance to Good Sir, should break any last hidden will to resist that might be left in his dray beasts' treacherous hearts. Meanwhile, this Friday was beautiful, with temperatures in the pleasant 20s and a blue sky growing bluer to the north along their line of travel. The heavy boat sat high on the sledge, while the wooden runners scratched and hissed as they slid across ice and gravel. In the bow, Magnus, recently dosed, was smiling, holding his belly with both hands and humming a soft tune. It was less than 30 miles to Terra Camp and John Irving's grave near Victory Point, they all knew, and less than half that to Lieutenant LeVeconte's grave along the coast. With the men strong, they were covering 2 to 3 miles each day, and would probably do better if their diet improved again. To that end, Hickey had just torn a blank page out of one of the multiple Bibles that Magnus had insisted upon gathering up and loading into the pinnace when they left rescue camp. Never mind that the gentle idiot did not know how to read, and was now tearing that page into 11 equal little strips of paper. Hickey, of course, would be exempt from the coming lottery, as would Magnus and the goddamned surgeon. But tonight, when they stopped to brew up tea in the evening stew, Hickey would have each man write his own name or put his sign on one of the slips of paper, and all would be ready for the lottery itself. Hickey would have Good Sir look the slips over and publicly confirm that each man had signed his own true name or unique sign. Then the names would go into the king's peacoat pocket, in preparation for the solemn ceremony to come. Chapter 58. Good Sir. On the southwest cape of King William Island, 5 October 1848. From the personal diary of Dr. Harry D. S. Good Sir. 6, 7, or perhaps 8 October 1848. I have taken the final draft. It will be a few minutes before the full effect is felt. Until it is, I shall catch up on my diary. These last few days I have been recording the details of how young Hodgson confided in me
and whispered to me in the tent weeks ago on that last night before Mr. Hickey shot him. The lieutenant whispered, "I apologize for disturbing you, Doctor, but I have to tell someone I am sorry." I whispered back, "You are not a papist, Lieutenant Hodgson, and I am not your confessor. Go to sleep, and let me sleep." Hodgson insisted, "I apologize again, Doctor, but I have to tell someone how sorry I am for betraying the captain, who was always good to me, and for allowing Mr. Hickey to take you captive like this. I sincerely regret it, and I'm dreadfully sorry."
I lay there silently, saying nothing, giving the boy nothing.
"Ever since John was killed," persisted Hodgson, Lieutenant Irving, my dear friend from gunnery school, "I have been convinced that Colker's mate Hickey committed the murder, and I have been terrified of him."
"Why would you throw in your lot with Mr. Hickey if you thought him a monster?" I whispered in the dark.
"I was afraid. I wanted to be on his side because he was so terrible," whispered Hodgson.
And then the boy began to weep. I said, "Shame on you." But I put my arm around the boy and patted his back while he wept until he fell asleep. The next morning, Mr. Hickey assembled everyone and had Magnus Manson force Lieutenant Hodgson to kneel before him, while the Colker's mate brandished his pistol and announced how he, Mr. Hickey, would brook no shirking, explaining again how the good men amongst us would eat and live, while the shirkers would die. Then he set the long-barreled weapon to the base of George Hodgson's skull and blew his brains out onto the gravel. I have to say that the boy was brave at his end. He showed no fear at all that morning. His last words before the pistol's explosive discharge were, "You can go to hell." I only wish that my end would be so brave, but I know now for a certainty that it will not. Mr. Hickey's theatricals were not at an end with the death of Lieutenant Hodgson, nor when Magnus Manson stripped the boy naked and left his corpse lying there in front of the assembly. The sight made my chest hurt. Speaking as a man of medicine, poor Hodgson was thinner than I would have thought possible with any recently living human being. His arms were mere sheaths of skin along bones. His ribs and pelvis pressed outward so fiercely against the skin that they threatened to burst through. And everywhere the boy's flesh was mottled with bruises. Nonetheless, Mr. Hickey called me forward, handed me a pair of shears, and insisted that I begin dissecting the lieutenant in front of the assembled men. I demurred. "Mr. Hickey," his voice pleasant, asked again. I demurred again. Mr. Hickey then commanded Mr. Manson to take the shears from me and to strip me as naked as the corpse at our feet. Once I was without clothing, Mr. Hickey paced back and forth in front of the men and pointed to my naked features. Mr. Manson stood nearby holding the shears. "There ain't no room for shirkers in our band of brothers," said Mr. Hickey. "And while we need this surgeon, for I do plan to take care of your dear men's health, every man jack of you, he must be punished when he refuses to serve our common good. Twice he has refused this morning. We shall remove two unessential appendages as a sign of our displeasure." And with that, Mr. Hickey proceeded to prod at different parts of my anatomy with the pistol barrel. My fingers, my nose, my penis, my testicles, my ears. Then he raised my hand. "A surgeon needs his fingers if he's going to be any use to us," he announced theatrically and laughed. "We'll save those for last." Most of the men laughed. "He don't need his pizzle nor bollocks, though," said Mr. Hickey, prodding at the aforementioned parts with his very cold pistol barrel. The men laughed again. The anticipation, I think, was very high.
But today we is merciful, said Mr. Hickey.
He then ordered Mr. Manson to lop off two of my toes.
Which two, Cornelius?
Asked the large idiot.
You choose, Magnus, said our master of ceremonies.
The assembled men laughed yet again. I could sense their disappointment that something so banal as mere toes were being removed. Yet I could also tell that they enjoyed seeing Magnus Manson as the master of my phalangeal fate. It was not their fault. The average seaman turned out here had no formal education whatsoever, and disliked anyone who did. Mr. Manson chose my two big toes. The audience laughed and applauded. The shears were applied quickly, and Mr. Manson's great strength worked to my advantage in the procedure. There was more laughter and great interest as my medical kit was brought, and everyone watched as I tied off necessary arteries, stemmed the bleeding as best I could, all the while feeling rather faint, and applied preliminary dressings to the wounds. Mr. Manson was directed to carry me back to my tent. His ministrations were as gentle as a mother's to a sick child. That was also the day when Mr. Hickey thought to relieve me of my more efficacious medicinal bottles. But before that morning, I had already poured the majority of the morphine, opium, laudanum, Dover's powders, poisonous mercury calomel, and mandragora into a single opaque and innocent-looking bottle marked sugar of lead, and hidden that somewhere other than my medical kit. I had then used water to bring the visible levels of morphine, opium, and laudanum up to the previous heights. The irony here is that each time I dose Mr. Manson for his tummy aches, he is receiving more than 8 parts water to 2 small parts morphine. The giant does not seem to notice the loss of efficacy, however, which once again reminds me of the importance of belief in the entire medical process. Since that day of Lieutenant Hodgson's demise, I have demurred again to the sum of 8 more toes, 1 ear, and my foreskin. The last operation created so much mirth among the assembled men, despite the fresh corpses lying in front of them, that one would have thought that the circus had come to perform for them. I know why Mr. Hickey has never made good on his repeated threats to relieve me of my male member or testicles. The caulker's mate has seen enough shipboard injuries to know that bleeding from such wounds often cannot be stopped, especially when the surgeon is the one bleeding and quite apt to be unconscious or suffering from shock when the operation must necessarily be performed. And Mr. Hickey does not want me dead. Walking has been very difficult since my 7th through 10th toes have been removed. I had never truly understood how essential our digits are for balance, and the pain, of course, over the past month has not been insignificant. I think I would be committing the sin of pride, not to mention that of lying, if I said here that I had not considered drinking from my hidden bottle of morphine, opium, and laudanum, and other materia medica, all mixed into the hidden bottle I have thought of for so many weeks as my final draft. But I never took the bottle out of hiding, not until this hour. I confess I had thought the effect would be more rapid than it is proving. I can no longer feel my feet, which is a blessing, and my legs have just gone numb up to the patella. But at this rate it will be another 10 minutes or more before the potion reaches and stills my heart and other vital organs. I have just drunk more of the final draught. I suspect I was a coward for not drinking it all down at once to begin with. I confess here, for purely scientific purposes, should someone someday discover this diary, that the mixture is not only quite potent but quite intoxicating. If anyone else here were alive this dark, stormy afternoon, except for Mr. Hickey and possibly Mr. Manson up in their throne pinnace, they should see my last moments spent with bobbing head and drunkard's grin. but I do not recommend that this experiment be repeated for anything but the most dire of medicinal purposes. And this leads to a true confession. For the first and only time in my medical career and life, I have not served a patient to the utmost of my ability. I speak, of course, in regards to poor Mr. Magnus Manson. My initial diagnosis of the twin gunshot wounds was a lie. The bullets were small of caliber, it is true, but the tiny pistol must have packed a great charge of powder, for both projectiles had, it was obvious from my first inspection, penetrated the idiot giant's skin, flesh, muscle layer, and stomach lining. From my first consultation, I had known that the bullets were in Mr. Manson's belly, spleen, liver, or some other vital organ, and that his survival depended upon exploratory and then removal surgery. I lied. If there is a hell, in which I no longer believe, since this earth and some of the people in it are hell enough for any universe, I would be and should be cast down to the worst bulgia of the lowest circle. I don't care. I should say here, my chest is now cold, and my fingers are also growing cold. When the storm struck about 1 month ago, I thanked God. It seemed at the time that we were actually going to get to terror camp. It seemed that Mr. Hickey had won. We were, I believe, less than 20 miles from that camp, and progressing 3 or 4 miles a day in now perfect weather, when the fist of the endless storms hit. If there is a God, I thank you, dear God. Snow, darkness, terrible winds day and night. Even the men who could walk could not pull. The harnesses were abandoned. The tents blew down, then blew away. The temperature dropped 50 degrees. Winter had struck like God's hammer, and Mr. Hickey could do nothing but set tops aside his thrown pinnace and shoot half the men to feed the other half. Some men ran away into the blizzards and died. Some men stayed and were shot. Some men froze to death. Some men ate the other men and died anyway. Mr. Hickey and Mr. Manson sit up there in the boat in the wind. I think, but do not know, but Mr. Manson is no longer living.
Oh, I killed him. I killed the men I left behind a rescue camp. I'm so sorry. I am so sorry. All my life, my brother knows. I wish my brother were here now. Most knows. All my life, I've loved Plato and the dialogues of Socrates. Like the Greek Socrates, but not Durf, not Greet I. The poison, much deserved, moves up through my torso and deadens my limbs and turns my fingers, surgeon's fingers, to unfeeling sticks, and so glad. Wrote the note, no pained, to my chest before this. Eat these mortal remains of Dr. Harry T. S.
Good sir, if you wish, the poison within his bones and flesh will kill you also. The men at risk camp. Thomas, if they find this upon my and red eye, so sorry. I did my best, but never is. Mr. Manson wounds. I am not. God watch over the men.
Chapter 59. Hickey. On the southwest cape of King William Island, 18 October, 1848. Sometime in the last few days or weeks, Cornelius Hickey realized he had ceased being a king. He was now a god. In fact, he suspected, was not yet certain, but suspected strongly and was close to certain, Cornelius Hickey had become God. Others died around him, yet he lived. He no longer felt the cold. He no longer felt hunger or thirst, much less the need to slake those former appetites. He could see in the encroaching dark as the nights lengthened toward their absolute, nor did the blowing snow and howling wind hinder his senses. The mere mortal men had required a rigging of a tarp from the boat and sledge when their tents ripped and blew away, and they huddled there like sheep, with their woolen asses turned to the wind until they died. But Hickey was comfortable high on his throne in the stern of the pinnace. When, after more than 3 weeks of being unable to move because of the blizzards, winds, and plummeting temperatures, his dray beasts had whined and begged for food, Hickey had descended among them like a god and provided them with their loaves and fishes. He had shot Strickland to feed Seeley. He had shot Dunn to feed Brown. He had shot Gibson to feed Jerry. He had shot Best to feed Smith. He had shot Morfan to feed Oren. Or perhaps it was all the other way around. Hickey's memory could no longer be bothered with trivial matters. But now those he'd so generously fed were dead, frozen hard into their blanket sleeping bags, or contorted into the terrible claw shapes of their final throes. Perhaps he had become bored with them and shot them as well. He did vaguely remember carving up the choice parts of more men than he had shot to feed the others in the past week or two, back when he still needed to eat. Or perhaps it had just been on a whim. He could not recall the details. It was not important. When the storms ended, and Hickey now knew that he could command them to cease at any time if it pleased him to do so, he would probably bring several of the men back from the dead so that they could finish hauling Magnus and him to Terror Camp. The damned surgeon was dead, poisoned, and frozen in his own little tarp tent some yards from the pinnace and the common graveyard tarp. But Hickey chose to ignore that unpleasant development. It was but a mild irritation. Even gods have phobias, and Cornelius Hickey had always held a deep fear of poison or contamination. After one glance, and after firing a single bullet into the corpse from the entrance to the tarp tent, to make sure the damned surgeon was not feigning death, the new god Hickey had backed away and left the poisoned thing and its contaminated shroud tarp alone. Magnus had been mewling and complaining for weeks from his favoured place in the bow, but had been strangely quiet the last day or two. His last movement, during a lull in the blizzards when a dull winter light had illuminated the pinnace and the snow-buried tarp next to it, and the low hill they were on, and the frozen beach to the west, and endless ice fields beyond, had been to open his mouth, as if to make a request of his lover and God. but instead of words issuing forth, or even another complaint, hot blood had first filled and then gazed from Magnus's open mouth, flowed down his bearded chin and covered the big man's belly and gently folded hands, ending in a pool on the bottom of the boat near his boots. The blood was still there, but frozen now into waves and ripples, looking like nothing so much as some biblical prophet's flowing but ice-covered brown beard. Magnus had not spoken again since. His partner's brief death nap did not disturb Hickey. He knew that he could bring Magnus back whenever he chose to, but the open eyes endlessly staring over that gaping mouth and frozen ice fall of blood began to get on the god's nerves after a day or two. It was especially hard to wake up to, especially after the eyes frosted over and became two white, icy, never-blinking orbs. Hickey had stirred from his throne in the stern then, crawling forward past the propped shotgun and bag of powder-shot cartridges over the center thwarts, past the heaps of wrapped chocolate, which he might deign to eat if hunger ever returned, and past the saws and nails and rolls of sheet lead, stepping over the towels and silk handkerchiefs stacked so neatly near Magnus's bloodied feet, finally kicking aside some of the Bibles that his friend had pulled close to him in the last days, stacking them like a little wall between Hickey and himself. But Magnus's mouth would not shut. Hickey could not even snap off or chip away the thick river of frozen blood, nor would the white eyes close.
"I'm sorry, love," he whispered, "but you know how I hate being stared at."
He had used his ship's knife to pry out the frozen eyeballs and throw them far out into the howling darkness. He would fix that later when he brought Magnus back. Finally, upon his command, the storm lessened and then died away. The howling ceased. The snow was piled 5 feet high on the westward windward side of the pinnace high atop its sledge and had filled in much of the space under the death tarp on the leeward side. It was very cold, and Hickey's preternatural vision could see more dark clouds moving in from the north. But for this evening the world was calm. He saw the sun set in the south and knew that it would be 16 or 18 hours until it rose again, also in the south, and that soon it would not rise at all. It would then be the age of darkness, 10,000 years of darkness. But that suited Cornelius Hickey's purposes well. But this night was cold and gentle. The stars were bright. Hickey had been taught the names of some of the winter constellations now rising, but this night he had trouble even finding the plough, and he was content to sit in the stern of his boat, his peacoat and watch cap keeping him perfectly warm, his gloved hands on the gunwales, his gaze locked forward in the direction of Terra Camp, and even the distant ship he would reach when he chose to bring his dray beasts and consort back to life. He was thinking about months and years past, and marveling at the inevitable miracle of his own transcendence. Cornelius Hickey had no regrets about any part of his former mortal life. He had done what he had to do. He had repaid those arrogant bastards who made the mistake of ever looking down upon him, and shown the others a hint of his divine light. Suddenly, he sensed movement to the west. With some difficulty, it was very cold, Hickey turned his head left to look out to the frozen sea. Something was moving toward him. Perhaps it had been his hearing, as preternatural and supernatural as all his other fine-tuned and augmented senses now, that had first detected the movement across the broken ice. Something large was walking toward him on two legs. Hickey saw the starlight glow on the blue-white fur. He smiled. He welcomed the visit. The thing from the ice was no longer something to be feared. Hickey knew that it came now not as a predator, but as a worshipper. He and the creature were not even equals at this point. Cornelius Hickey could order it into non-existence, or banish it to the farthest reaches of the universe with a sweep of his gloved hand. It came on, sometimes dropping to lope forward on all fours, more often rising on two huge legs and striding like a man, even while moving nothing like a man. Hickey felt a strange disquiet disturb his deep cosmic peace. The thing disappeared from his sight when it came very close to the pinnace and sledge. Hickey could hear it moving around by the tarp, under the tarp, worrying the frozen bodies there with its long claws, clicking teeth the size of knives, huffing its breath out from time to time, but he could not see it. He realized that he was afraid to turn his head. He looked straight forward, meeting only Magnus's empty, eye-socketed gaze. Then suddenly the thing was there, looming over the gunwales, the upper body rising 6 feet and more above a boat that was already raised 6 feet above the sledge and snow. Hickey felt his breath catch in his chest. In the starlight, with Hickey's new improved vision, the beast was more terrible than he had ever seen it, more terrible than he could have ever imagined it. Just as he, Cornelius Hickey, had undergone a wonderful and terrible transformation, so had this creature. It leaned its huge upper body over the gunwales. It huffed a fog of ice crystals into the air between Hickey and the bow, and the Kulka's mate inhaled the carrion breath of 1,000 centuries of death-dealing. Hickey would have fallen to his knees and worshipped the creature at that moment if movement had been an option. But he was quite literally frozen in place. Even his head would no longer turn. The thing sniffed Magnus Manson's body, the long, impossible snout returning again and again to the ice fall of brown blood covering Magnus's front. Its huge tongue gently licked at the frozen fall of brown blood. Hickey wanted to explain that this was the body of his beloved consort, and that it must be preserved so that he, not Hickey the Kulka's mate, but the he had become, could restore his beloved's eyes and someday breathe life into him again. Abruptly, yet almost casually, the thing bit off Magnus's head. The crunching was so terrible that Hickey would have covered his ears if he had been able to lift his gloved hands from the gunwales. He could not move them. The thing swung a white furred forearm thicker than Magnus's massive leg had ever been and smashed the dead man's chest in, ribcage and spine exploding outward in a shower of white bone shards. Hickey realized that the thing had not broken Magnus the way Hickey had seen Magnus break a score of lesser man's backs and ribs. It had shattered Magnus the way a man would shatter a bottle or porcelain doll.
"Looking for a soul to devour?" thought Hickey, who had no idea why he had thought it.
Hickey could no longer move his head even an inch, so he had no choice but to watch as the thing from the ice excavated every inner part of Magnus Manson and ate them, crunching the bits in its huge teeth the way Hickey might have once chewed ice cubes. The thing then tore the frozen flesh from Magnus's frozen bones and scattered the bones throughout the bow of the pinnace, but only after cracking them open and sucking out the marrow. The wind came up and howled around the pinnace and sledge, creating distinct musical notes. Hickey imagined a mad god-thing from hell in a white fur coat playing a bone flute. It came for him next. First, it dropped to all fours out of sight, which was somehow more terrifying than his being able to see it. And then, with a vertical motion like a pressure ridge rising, it loomed up and over the side of the gunwale and filled all of Hickey's vision. Its black, unblinking, inhuman, totally unfeeling eyes were inches from the Calker's mate's own staring eyes. Its hot breath enveloped him.
"Oh,"
said Cornelius Hickey. It was the last word that Hickey ever spoke, but it was not so much a word as a single, long, terrified, speechless exhalation. Hickey felt his own last warm breath flowing out of him, out from his chest, up his throat, out through his open and straining mouth, hissing away between his shattered teeth. But instantly he realized it was not his breath leaving him forever, but his spirit, his soul. The thing breathed it in. But then the creature huffed, snorted, backed away, shook its huge head as if it had been befouled. It dropped to all fours and left Cornelius Hickey's field of vision forever. Everything had left Cornelius Hickey's field of vision forever. The stars came down from the sky and attached themselves to his staring eyes as ice crystals. The raven descended as a darkness upon him and devoured what the turnback would not deign to touch. Eventually, Hickey's blind eyes shattered from the cold. But he did not blink. His body remained sitting rigidly upright in the stern, legs splayed, boots firmly planted near the heap of gold watches he had plundered, and the stack of clothing he had taken from the dead men. His gloved hands frozen to the gunwales, the frozen fingers of his right hand only inches from the loaded shotgun's barrels. Late the next morning, before dawn, the storm front arrived and the sky began to howl again. And all that next day, and all the next night, the snow piled up in the Calker's mate's straining open mouth and covered his dark blue peacoat and watch cap and terror-frozen face and shattered, staring eyes with a thin shroud layer of white. Chapter 60 Crozier. The beauty of being dead, he knows now, is that there is no pain and no sense of self. The unhappy news about being dead, he knows now, is, just as he had feared many times when considering self-murder and rejecting it for just this reason, there are dreams. The happy news about this unhappy news is that the dreams are not one's own. Crozier floats in this warm, buoyant sea of non-self and listens to dreams that are not his own. If any of his living, mortal self's analytical powers had survived the transition to this pleasant floating after death, the old Francis Crozier might have wondered at his thought of listening to dreams. But it is true that these dreams are more like listening to another person's chant, although there is no language involved, no words, no music, no chant, than seeing dreams the way he always had when he was alive. Although there are most definitely visual images involved in this dream listening, the shapes and colours are like nothing Francis Crozier ever encountered on the other side of death's veil, and it is this non-voice, non-chant narrative that fills his death dreams. There is a beautiful Eskimo girl named Sedna. She lives alone with her father in a snow house far north of the regular Eskimo villages. Word of the girl's beauty spreads, and various young men make the long trek across ice floes and barren lands to pay homage to the grey-haired father and to woo Sedna. The girl's heart is not touched by any of the suitor's words, or faces, or forms. And in the late spring of the year, when the ice is breaking up, she goes out alone among the floes to avoid yet another year's fresh crop of moon-faced suitors. Since this happened in the time when animals still had voices, which the people understood, a bird flies over the opening ice and woos Sedna with its song. Come with me to the land of the birds, where all things are as beautiful as my song, sings the bird. Come with me to the land of the birds, where there is no hunger, where your tent will always be made of the most beautiful caribou skins, where you shall lie on only the finest and softest bearskins and caribou skin, and where your lamp will always be filled with oil. My friends and I will bring you anything your heart may desire, and you shall be clothed from that day forth in our finest and brightest feathers. Sedna believes the bird suitor, weds him in the tradition of the real people, and travels with him many leagues over sea and ice to the land of the bird people. But the bird had lied. Their home is not made of the finest caribou skins, but is a patched, sad place, thrown together with rotting fish skins. The cold wind blows in freely and laughs at her for her gullible innocence. She sleeps not on the finest bearskins, but on miserable walrus hides. There is no oil for her lamp. The other bird people ignore her, and she has to wear the same clothes she was wed in. Her new husband brings her only cold fish for her meals. Sedna keeps insisting to her indifferent bird husband that she misses her father. So finally the bird allows her father to come visit. To do so, the old man has to travel for many weeks in his frail boat. When her father arrives, Sedna feigns joy until they are alone in the dark, fish-stinking tent, and then she weeps and tells her father of how her husband abuses her and of all she has lost, youth, beauty, happiness, by marrying the bird rather than one of the young males of the real people. The father is horrified to hear this story and helps Sedna devise a plan to kill her husband. That next morning, when the bird husband returns with Sedna's cold fish for breakfast, the father and the girl fall upon the bird with the harpoon and paddle from the father's kayak and kill him. Then the father and daughter flee the land of the bird people. For days they sail south toward the land of the real people, but when the bird husband's family and friends find him dead, they are filled with anger and fly south, with a beating of wings so loud that it can be heard by the real people 1,000 leagues away. The sea distance that took Sedna and her father a week to sail is covered by the thousands of flying birds in a few minutes. They descend upon the little boat like a dark and angry cloud made up of beaks and talons and feathers. The beating of their wings calls up a terrible storm that raises the waves and threatens to swamp the little boat. The father decides to give his daughter back to the birds as an offering and throws her overboard. Sedna clings to the boat for dear life. Her grip is strong. The father takes his knife and cuts off the first joints of her fingers. As they fall into the sea, these finger joints are turned into the first whales. The fingernails become the white whalebone found on beaches. Still, Sedna clings. The father cuts off her fingers at the second joint. These parts of her fingers fall into the sea and become the seals. Still, Sedna clings. When the terrified father cuts off the final stumps of her fingers, these fall onto the passing floes and into the water and become the walruses. With no fingers left, only curved bone stumps like her dead bird husband's talons where her hands had been, Sedna finally falls into the sea and sinks to the bottom of the ocean. She resides there until this day. It is Sedna who is the mistress of all whales, walruses, and seals. If the real people please her, She sends the animals to them and tells the seals, walruses and whales to allow themselves to be caught and killed. If the real people displease her, she keeps the whales, walruses and seals with her down in the dark depths, and the real people suffer and starve.
What in the goddamned hell,
thinks Francis Crozier. It is his self voice that interrupts the slow, no-self flow of the dream listening. As if summoned, the pain rushes in.